Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media Safety and Security Virtual Summit, Track 2 on Modeling Drives Safety Critical Software Certification. My name is John McHale, Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems Magazine, and I will be the moderator for today's event. Today's speakers include Joe Vlad, Senior Director, Aerospace and Defense Marketing at Wind River, Bernard Dion, Chief Technology Officer for Estrel Technologies, Mirko Yakovlevich, Senior Marketing Manager, TT Tech, and our last speaker is Mark Hawthorne-Thwaite, Software Architect with Prestagis. The sponsors of this session are Estrel, Prestagis, TT Tech, and Wind River. Today's total briefing will consume about 50 minutes, leaving us 10 minutes or so for questions at the end. There are three buttons to take notice of, the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you will be able to view the slides full screen. You can also click the Forward to a Friend button to send an email of request for this event. You'll also find on your console window a button that allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to address them during the closing Q&A session, but if you have a question intended for a specific speaker, please note at the beginning of your question which speaker you mean it to go to. Else, I will just hand out the questions equally to all our speakers. If you have a question pertaining to the ECAST operation itself, one of our technicians will be happy to respond back to you during the ECAST. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the ECAST with more information. This ECAST will be posted online within 48 hours, and an audio podcast will also be available. More details will follow at the end of the event. So now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Joe Vlad of Wind River.
Thank you, John, and I'd like to extend my warm welcome to everybody for joining today. The first topic that we're going to cover will be safety certification for unmanned systems. And you may or may not know about what's happening in the unmanned systems world, but there is a lot of new technology that will have to comply with safety and security requirements as these systems get built out. And I'll describe during the presentation about the current state of the art with regard to certification in unmanned systems and talk about a working group that we're involved in that's helping define the next version of the architecture standards for which safety and security will be paramount in future unmanned vehicles. So with that, let's go ahead and talk about the trends of unmanned systems. And the first thing is there is rapid growth in all these unmanned systems. We're seeing a great proliferation of different vehicle types, different vehicle sizes, and different vehicle operations. If we just look at the military investments going into unmanned systems, the DoD will invest $20 billion in unmanned vehicles by year 2018. And the military is using these, of course, in theaters of operation in Iraq and Afghanistan today, and they're using many sizes and varieties of these vehicles. Some vehicles are actually launched by hand. Other vehicles use jet engines and fly at altitudes greater than 60,000 feet. Here in the United States, they use they often test those vehicles in military ranges, but in those military ranges, we do see occasionally these vehicles sharing national airspace, and this is where some regulatory compliance becomes important. Typically, the regulations would apply for any unmanned systems in the U.S. that fly above 400 feet. So the regulations don't apply to model builders who are building unmanned systems, but they typically apply to larger vehicles that fly at greater than 400 feet. And as we know today, these unmanned systems are deployed in war zones. So how do we get here? Well, currently the unmanned architectures that are used today are using a combination of commercial off-the-shelf software and hardware, and a combination of proprietary hardware and software. And these developers built these systems largely as prototypes. Some of the larger companies produce prototypes for the DoD in hopes of winning design business. And all those vehicles used, the air vehicles and ground vehicles, did not have standard interfaces to the systems which controlled them. And in often cases for the air systems, for example, you'd have a ground system that would communicate with these air vehicles. And each of those ground systems were unique to the vehicle that they communicated with. And what that meant was that you had no interoperability, and you currently have no interoperability among ground stations. So there's one ground station for one vehicle. So if a customer, for example, the DoD, wants to buy an unmanned system today, they have to buy a complete system that includes the vehicle, the ground stations, the software to control the ground stations, and probably even require some training to use all that equipment. The other things that are relevant to those systems that are deployed today, they have limited safety assurance, and they have limited security assurance. The vendors have done a good job of ensuring the reliability of these systems, but there have been recent events that vehicles have lost control, and we've had a couple of incidents where the vehicles have crashed, mostly in remote areas, and we don't have any deaths attributed to them. But we all recognize, the FAA recognizes, and DoD recognizes that we have to do a better job in ensuring the safety and security of these systems. So if you're not familiar, I put up here the FAA notice that applies to unmanned systems operations, at least in the United States. And this is a notice called Joint Order 7210.766, which is a mouthful, but this is how the FAA publishes notices. They're actually published yearly. So the notices, as published by the FAA, are effective usually for a year. They're not what they call orders that are permanent policy. They're temporary policy. And what it does is says that we recognize that unmanned systems pose a safety risk to the public. And they mandate that no unmanned systems operations in national airspace without specific authority from the FAA. And that generally applies to any vehicles flying below 60,000 feet. And that number is important because that's essentially the regulated airspace. So some of the vehicles that can fly above 60,000 feet would not necessarily need to be regulated. What they do is recommend operations in prohibited and restricted and warning area airspace. So effectively, you may see them tested in military operations areas, in prohibited airspace, which is means that general aviation and commercial aviation are not permitted to operate in those areas. But all the operators require a certificate of authorization, and that means they have to go through a rather elaborate process to get approval from the FAA to operate these vehicles. And part of that process includes getting specific operational procedures required. If there's loss of communications, if there's loss of control of the vehicle, what are the backup modes of operation? So they need to show the FAA that there's actually some pedigree of safety and some reversionary modes that the vehicle can operate in, such that there will be no harm brought to the public. So DoD recognizes that the systems that have been deployed, which were largely developed in R&D programs, need to have some improvements made. So DoD has actually defined a number of goals for these unmanned systems. And the first goal is to improve the integration and joint services collaboration of all these unmanned systems. So the Air Force may be using the air vehicles that are unmanned. Maybe the Army uses ground vehicles that are unmanned. We want to make sure those things are all interoperable, and that's their first goal. They want to achieve greater interoperability of all these system controls so that maybe one ground station can control multiple vehicles, not just air vehicles, but ground vehicles as well. They're also saying we need to define standards and procedures that enable safe and timely operations, implement standardized and positive control measures for these unmanned vehicles, and then support rapid demonstration and integration of these validated combat capabilities. So if the systems have weapons on them, we want to make sure that those capabilities are brought forth into the mainstream as well. And then, of course, they want to make sure that they save money. That's the last goal, is to improve costs. And by buying ad hoc systems where the ground system and vehicle are all integrated by a single vendor, if we have interoperability, we can get reusability and reduce costs overall. So one working group that's actually doing a lot of efforts to achieve those goals is called the Unmanned Control Systems Working Group. We actually participate in that group, and the sponsor of that particular group was the Office of the Secretary of Defense and a group in Huntsville, Alabama, namely, that sponsors this effort. There's a number of developers and companies working on defining the standards, and it's composed of both government personnel and industry representatives. And the source of standards that we're defining in the unmanned group include the API components for the operating systems and technologies, making sure that we have information assurance and safety requirements met. So we're mandating common criteria in DO 178 B and C certification requirements, and then ultimately coming up with an architecture model. And this is a services-based oriented, services-oriented architecture where essentially the unmanned systems developers can start to compose a set of services on their unmanned platforms. This next slide I have is a bit of an eye chart, but what it essentially says is there's the architecture that we're defining here is based on the MILS architecture that support both safety and security. And in each of these domains, you have a guest operating system that could support one or more services that might be classified or unclassified or just a maintenance service. So inside these domains, you could have services that the unmanned systems groups require for mission planning, flight control, classified services for dissemination of information among the vehicles, and security management. All these functions would reside on the architecture called the MILS platform in a single or multi-core architecture. So all these services-oriented architectures would be put on top of this platform and could be composed for the needs of the particular unmanned systems platforms that would be developed and deployed on a given program. So nowhere do we define exactly what these services are going to be. It's going to be composed by the AIM developers, and that's the true flexibility of this architecture. If you're interested in knowing more about this architecture, there's a link here for the UCS Architecture Organization. And if you're actually eager to participate in this working group, we'll be publishing the next version of the standard in December, but there will be ongoing work. You can actually enlist to join if you're a U.S. citizen and participate in the evolution of the group. Today there's probably 4 to 5 dozen members that are actively participating. There's about a dozen working groups that are involved at the moment. So it's a lot of collaboration and a lot of effort to hopefully define and achieve the goals of the DoD and unmanned systems. So with that, John, I'll turn it back over to you and the next speaker.
Thank you, Joe. Excellent presentation. And now I'll turn it over to our next speaker, Bernard Dionne of Estrel Technologies. Bernard?
Hello, this is Bernard. Just a technical problem. My internet connection is broken, so I will do it with you moving the slides. In the first place, we will now continue with looking at how to develop these mission and safety critical applications, and in particular when the certification objectives of D178B have to be met. And this is the current version of the standard, but also we'll look at the future version of the standard, which is D178C, that will appear next year. Before we do this, I will say, and go to the next slide, we'll say a few words about Estrel. So at Estrel, we provide tools and methods to develop these applications. And this is for system and software engineers to develop these applications. And we focus on specific modeling and verification activities. And also, from these models, we have automatic and certified code generation. And this certification has been done by the proper authorities, like FAA in the USA or EASA in Europe. Next slide. So the typical applications, you see them on this slide, like all Airbus aircrafts for flight controls, or more recently Boeing applications on the Boeing 787, or Sukhoi in Russia. So all the typical current civilian aircrafts, you can see them here. So now let's, on the next slide, let's look at today's objectives. First of all, we might say that our customers are fighting with a number of problems, difficulty to express correct specification, error-prone manual implementation and verification activities, finding errors late in the process, and overall, a cost of certification that is extremely high. So this is what we are going to fight today by providing these modeling techniques. So if we can go to the next slide, I just want to say now that the part that we address is the development of the application, and we'll do that with SCADE tools. So this is what we are going to consider today. We are not addressing the problem of developing the complete platform, including the hardware and the basic software. So I'll go to the next slide, and we'll start with the development activities following the 178B typical development flow. So if we go to the next slide, you see this flow, and this is regulated by the standard. It all starts from system specification, and we go down to the development of the software in phases: requirements, producing high-level requirements, design, producing low-level requirements and architecture, and then coding, producing source code, and then we get an executable. So this is the development flow. And now what we propose within this flow is to make a heavy use of modeling. And so for this, we have a tool called SCADE. And what you see on the next slide is an example of such a model, where you have a bit of a functionality, which we call a node. And if you look at the right part, there is a graphical representation with data flow schema block, which are typical notation in these control engineering disciplines. So this is an integrator, which is a typical part of an application in control systems. And in fact, these graphics represent equations, and these equations, you see them on the left part of the slide. So it just says that there is an interface with input and output to the node, and then it's every piece of data has a data type. So this is safe because it's strongly typed. And then the node itself describes a set of equations, which you see on the left in a textual classical notation. If we go to the next slide, I want also to say that this modeling notation is specifically designed for handling this kind of control application, and in particular, it is possible, since we have cycle-based application, we go into calculation cycles, it's possible to speak about time by saying, for example, I want to look at the previous value of some piece of data because I need to understand what it was at the previous instance. And this point is important from a modeling standpoint and from a point of view of finding errors. Here, at the top graphics, you see a counter. And in fact, the value of a counter is given by the previous value of this counter plus the value of the current input. And in the top design on this slide, there is an error because there is a design that says I take the previous value of the counter, but if we are at the initial instant, there is no previous value. And so this says it is wrong, and when you do the design, you know it's wrong, and typically you add an initial value to say when it starts, the value is zero, which is what you see at the drawing at the bottom. So in fact, if I go to the next slide now, what we do overall is to start, say, from a textual description of system requirements. And then for each of these requirements, you will design a SCADE model that will implement these requirements. And the view that you have here exhibits the fact that there is traceability that has to be established between the system requirements and these software models that we have designed. And piece by piece, we know what is the correspondence. Once you have done this design, you have established traceability with the system requirements, we see on the next slide that it is possible to produce automatically a design report, which is a complete description of the software model. If we go to the next slide, we see that from the design, here we have a state machine, which is also another part of the design notation. From a state machine, there is automatic generation of the source code of the application. So what you see on the right is C code, and there is an exact correspondence between the states of the state machine and the case parts of a switch case statement in the C code. So there is a direct correspondence between the model and the source code. But the point is that, and we see this on the next slide,
which slide are you on?
It's my slide 14, but I cannot tell you the number. The slide says SCADE Suite KCG Certification Kit. Is that okay?
Yeah. Could you repeat that? What is the title of the slide?
SCADE Suite KCG Certification Kit.
Thank you.
So, in fact, what we provide is a certified code generator, I should say a qualified code generator, and that means that we provide the confidence that the generated code is correct, and in order to do that, we formally qualify it with the certification authority in the course of the development of an aircraft project. So this is done by FAA or EASA, as for the aircraft, and they give the qualified status to the code generator, which means that the generated code, the source code, does not need to be verified. It is guaranteed to correspond to the design. Now, if we go to the next slide, we go into the verification activity because we've seen how we develop the application down to the source code. And now we can see on the next slide that we can test or simulate the models. So you have a view of simulation, which means that you create test cases, test scenarios, and you will run these test cases on models in simulation on your PC to make sure that the models are themselves a correct representation of the requirements. On the next slide, we go to a very important point in D178B, which is structural coverage. And typically, it is mandatory in a classical setting to cover all the parts of the software and typically, classically, the source code to show that everything has been exercised and nothing is dead, for example. So this part, what we see here is that we can do it at model level, and there is an interface in the tool to make sure that all the model elements have been correctly exercised using color codes. The goal is to get everything green to say everything has been exercised. So, and it is much more efficient to do these activities at model level than it was to do them at source code level. Finally, if we go to the next slide, we see that we've been from the system requirements to the software model in SCADE. We've used the KCG certified code generator, we know that the code is correct. Now there may be remaining problems with the compiler, and for this we provide a test suite that is going to exercise the compiler with typical code that is generated by the code generator. So this is what we call the compiler verification kit. And so this is the end of the development and verification cycle. And again, the emphasis is on using modeling techniques rather than going down to manual development of source code to do most of the verification activities that have to be done and that are regulated at model level rather than doing them further down in the cycle. So this is something that we have proposed for quite a long time in the course of using D178B. And now we can look at the situation for the new version of the standard, that is D178C. So if we look at the slide that says why did we need to develop D178C, well, we see, first of all, that it is quite old. It was written in 1992, and software engineering has progressed a lot since that time. There has been new techniques like model-based design, which we discussed, but also formal methods, automatic code generation. So there was a need to put this directly into a new version of the standard. And also, the authorities, the aircraft manufacturers had a lot of discussion in the meantime, and there was a need to put that into a new standard. So if we go to the next slide, the 178C highlights, what we see here is that we provide a more careful explanation of what is at the root of DO178. In fact, we do not raise or lower the bar for certification, but we better explain what it is about. And moreover, we've added what we call supplements, which are technology supplements, like the model-based supplement, or the object-oriented supplement, or the formal method supplement, which are specific to new technologies. And moreover, we have added a supplement which precisely describes how to qualify a tool. So this is Essentially, what we've done in the D1CMDT committee, and again, this is going to be available and the official regulation starting next year. To finish this presentation, I just want to say that, of course, we are ready with the skate tools to help you transition to the new standard, because we have been using in the past and will be using or providing these methods that we just described, and they fit very well in the new version of the standard. And just to conclude on the next last slide, I just want to say that this is meant to solve the problem that we discussed in the beginning, which is how to get better specification, how to find errors very early in the development cycle, rather than at the end, which we all know is very costly. So in the end, the overall goal is to achieve certification at less of a cost. So I'm done with the presentation, and I will send it back to John.
Thank you so much, Bernard. Excellent presentation. And now for our next speaker, Mirko from TT Tech. Mirko, take it away.
Thank you, John. Thank you. So today we will discuss deterministic Ethernet impact on system design, safety, and security. My name is Mirko Kovljevic. I'm from TT Tech. TT Tech is a specialist in deterministic networks and highly reliable platforms for different aerospace, defense, automotive, and industry applications. We are working on system integration in different critical infrastructure programs, and I will provide more information on technology which is offering unified networking and deterministic networking, so-called time-triggered Ethernet. So as everybody knows, deterministic communication in Ethernet was not really very, very well understood. So Ethernet was designed basically as a packet switching technology, and it's a best effort communication approach. And over time, it penetrated into different domains, and people tried to work to add more determinism into the network, and those capabilities has been expanded over the last 15-20 years. So we started with a completely indeterministic Ethernet, then went through more deterministic Ethernet with capabilities which are described in VLAN, for example, and prioritization. Also, there's something we call very deterministic. So Ethernet today, as is, can cover something between indeterministic to very deterministic type of communication. And the only thing Ethernet could not do was strictly deterministic. So this was a domain which was restricted only on circuit switching technologies like SONET or TDMA style technologies. So with expansion or adding new capabilities for TDMA-type communication over Ethernet, basically we would be able to cover all types of determinism and have something we call deterministic unified Ethernet. This means a network which is Ethernet and has additional services which can offer this capability. So what does it mean for design of systems? This means we can have a network switch which can handle soft time to hard real time functions. We can have audio, video, critical controls, and also standard LAN application in one network. And it is not possible to really influence operation of highly critical functions. So this means robust bandwidth partitioning. We can integrate critical and non-critical data streams with different quality of service requirements. Then it means unified networking. So this means I can have a low latency streams, lossless communication, and standard LAN application in one network. And also, this allows efficient resource use because it allows maximized bandwidth utilization. And especially in cases where you have different types of quality of service, for example, hard real time and a lot of bulk data which is downloaded, This is something you cannot do with standard Ethernet or Ethernet which doesn't have a TDMA type of capabilities for communication. You would use much. You would be pressed to use only very small portion of bandwidth to ensure that highly critical streams have all the timing properties they need for their operation. So there's a TT Ethernet standard, which is designed in SAE. There was a group, or there's a committee called the AS2, Embedded Computing System Committee, and the idea was to design a service or extension or enhancement to Ethernet, which can allow use of Ethernet as a high bandwidth network for protocol for time, mission, and safety critical systems in different applications. And the idea was to have something that some networks where we can have critical control systems, audio, video, and standard LAN application in one Ethernet network. So this is very interesting for applications which rely on a reduced size, weight, and power, and also for applications which are really highly integrated, where different functions reside and use common resources. The initial push for this standardization effort was U.S. Human Spaceflight Program, and COTS components compliant with this standard are used in NASA Orion exploration vehicle, and also there are different other aerospace, defense, and right now automotive applications which profit from this technology. Also, we have programs which are in energy domain, focused on energy production and control of alternative energy facilities. So the technical work on this standard is completed. Ballot, the committee has approved the standard in ballot in July, and we expect release in this quarter 2011. So earliest date for release is scheduled for some late October this year. Now, how this works? What is it, actually, this standard? We call it time-triggered Ethernet, or TT Ethernet in short. And basically, the standard describes layer 2 quality of service enhancement, which works in parallel to other layer 2 services. So basically, you can compare it to some special, strictly deterministic version of VLAN, and it offers synchronous communication, synchronization of different systems or global clock, robust fault-tolerant distributed clock, and synchronization recovery in the systems, and also adds different capabilities which allow TDMA-type communication over, so synchronous communication in Ethernet-based networks under different loads. So this means Ethernet viable for any critical embedded system application. Normally, TT Ethernet switches provide different services, and depending on services which they provide, you can have different capabilities. And also, if you have, for example, services like ARINC 664, and which is rate constrained, and if you have a time-triggered service, which is specifically designed in this standard, and other standard switch services, then you have a good baseline for designing deterministic unified networks. As you can see on this slide, you can see several pipes. This basically big pipe is just representing many virtual links. So we have a standard physical layer. It can be any type of standard Ethernet layer, any type of cable, and through this cable, actually, several types of traffic are going through. So we can have synchronous traffic, and we have priority-based asynchronous traffic. So synchronous traffic is driven solely by time. In our case, time is fault-tolerant, driven by fault-tolerant distributed clock, and all units in the system know what the time is. We are talking about system time. There's no transmission of any wall clock around the system. Therefore, this algorithm is extremely, extremely requires low bandwidth for its operation, and we can have also rate constraint, ERRING 664 traffic in the system, and standard best effort traffic. So all this asynchronous traffic will not influence synchronous streams in the system. This allows us to design a system which can deliver synchronous services, audio, video, for example, radars or critical controls. And in the asynchronous part, we can have different other services, different other applications using standard LAN, and which require some less stringent quality of service. In aerospace and defense applications, it is interesting to know that mostly integrated systems are module-level concepts. So basically, we talk about a software platform which is running on a module. We have some time and space partitioning, and this is something that happens really on the module. If we want to expand all the benefits of those module-level concepts to the whole system, we would need really strict determinism at a network level. We would need distributed fault tolerant time and capabilities to have a system which operates as a big fault tolerant distributed embedded computer. So the level of robust resource partitioning we have at the module level should be also available at a network level in order to design systems which are really operating as fault-tolerant distributed embedded computers. So in this case, you can see how a system looks like. Basically, you have some front-end sensors. These can be missile warnings, radars, different types of sensors. You take this data and they flow through a fault-tolerant Ethernet, DT Ethernet backbone network. And then you have some mission systems, common core systems, which have a backplane. If this backplane is gigabit Ethernet based, like in a VPX backplane, then you have a situation where you can also add time-triggered Ethernet capability to the switches. But basically, you have a big network which where all the modules actually share a network resource because of this TDMA-style communication and strict determinism in the network. Also, less critical functions can freely use a synchronous part of the bandwidth, which is then allowing them actually to operate and do not disturb really critical functions which enjoy time-triggered communication. Here's one example how a platform can be built based on time-triggered Ethernet and VxWorks, and as you can see in this red part, you can see a partitioning operating system with partitioning communication system with time-triggered Ethernet creating a specific distributed platform. This platform consists of or relies on time-space partitioning of computing resources and time partitioning of the underlying networking resource. At the same time, you can also add to the system a set of non-critical functions in the same system, which are not going to influence all those critical functions. So we actually have a capability to split critical and non-critical functions, simplify their certification, because there's a guarantee of robust partitioning in the system. And also, deterministic Ethernet communication with, or time-triggered streams have a very important property. They allow exact alignment of different functions in system and definition of key system interfaces. By having very well-defined, unambiguous key system interfaces, we are able to simplify system design, to reduce the complexity of the system, and to reduce the cost of integration system design, certification, maintenance, and upgrades. This means if you add another unit into a system which is already working as prescribed, you will save significant amount of effort because all existing functions will not be influenced by any other function which is added into the system. So you cannot, new functions, new units are not going to change the timing and performance of all other functions in the system which are running in synchronous time-triggered mode. So this is very useful for different types of programs. You really need to know how your system is going to behave at design time, and this allows you to design very efficiently platforms for different types of critical systems. So this is the end of my presentation for today. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Mirko. Excellent presentation. Before I turn it over to our final speaker, I just want to thank the audience for the questions they submitted. We will be getting to them immediately following the next speaker. But please submit any questions you have on the presentations we've had so far on unmanned systems development, TT, Ethernet, and DO-178C, all interesting topics and more. And now I'll turn it over for our final speaker, Mark Hawthorne-Thwaite of Presagis. Mark, take it away.
Thanks, John. Hi, everyone. So I'm going to talk today about object-oriented and model-based development using DO-178B and DO-178C in certification programs. So first of all, just a little bit about Presagis. So who are we? We're providers of COTS software for embedded graphics development. We have HMI modeling tools for cockpit displays development. So our newer tools, VAP6T and VAP6T178 for certifiable applications, and our legacy products, VAPS and VAPS-QCG. All these HMI development products have DO-178B qualifiable co-generators that co-generate from the model to deploy the application. We also have OpenGL graphics drivers, again for embedded systems. These are the C-Wind and C-Wind 178 certifiable drivers. We've been in this business quite some time now, and we have many deployed programs. There's a list there you see of various customers, and we have a global presence. Okay, so a little overview of what I'm going to talk about today. Basically, I'm going to give you some background on some of the drivers behind DO-178C. I'm going to give a few details about some specific areas of interest in DO-178C. That's object-oriented or OO and model-based development. I'm going to go into a little bit more detail on some aspects of OO, and then I'm going to summarize things for you at the end. Okay, so the background. So object-oriented technology and model-based development, they weren't really in scope when DO-178B was first published in 1992. The same can be said for formal methods and, to a certain extent, tool qualification, though tool qualification is briefly accounted for and mentioned in DO-178B. There weren't very many details, and it's been an area of vagueness. So OOT and model-based development and qualified tools, they have nevertheless been used in avionics certification projects under DO-178B. And really what DO-178C is going to do is to standardize based on the current best practices that the big airframers are doing. So DO-178C will provide guidance for the use of object-oriented and model-based in specific supplements. There's also a supplement for formal methods, and there's a new DO document. It doesn't have a number yet, but it's going to be a new document for tool qualification, which has been recognized actually as a separate domain to airborne software, and it's also applicable to ground-based and to hardware development tools used in those domains. Okay, so a little summary of DO-178C. So it's been developed by the RTCA, Subcommittee 205. The different documents within that subcommittee have developed. Obviously, there's DO-178C itself that gives the guidelines for airborne software, DO-278A for ground-based software, which is very similar to DO-178C, DO-248C, which is now supporting information, so facts and discussion papers for DO-178C and DO-278A. Then the supplements, these have been designed to cater for newer technologies, and they're expandable so that new supplements can be added in the future. So currently we have OO, model-based and formal methods. And then, as I mentioned before, the tool qualification considerations is it's a document in its own right. So a bit more details of the 178C. So there's some common themes going on there. First of all, it's not really going beyond typical current best practice under D178B, neither is it reducing objectives of D178B. Really, it's clarifying and filling holes in the guidance, and it's providing focused guidance for newer technologies. So there isn't really much change in the core guidance at all. There are some synergies between D178C model-based OO and tool qualification. Basically, it's reflecting the dynamics of industry. I mean, these things have been going on. There's been increased use of models and abstraction and tools. So what D178C is going to do is to enable more powerful development techniques to tackle the issues that everybody realizes of increased system complexity. And just a point to note there that D178C has been it's been developed, and these issues have been recognized by both industry and the certification authorities. So now to focus on the two supplements of interest to my presentation today, model-based and OO. So first of all, model-based supplement. So this covers development and verification when you're using a model to express software requirements. So that's really the key point there, that these are software requirements under D178, and they're expressed in a model. So some of the guidance that's in D178, the model-based supplement, model standards. So these are analogous to requirements or design standards that you would have in traditional development. You need to define what the model means. If it's going to be requirements, you need standards to say what it means and how you apply it. You have to have traceability to requirements from the requirements from which the model is derived, because you need to have some traditional textual requirements above the model. You need to do model coverage analysis. So this is to ensure coverage of the model by testing. Typically, these are higher level tests of those requirements from which the model was derived. But you need to show you cover the model completely so that there's no unintended function. Also, model simulation. So this is where you can use execution of the model using tools to help to verify some of the objectives and help to validate your requirements. So some of the goals of the model-based supplement there, it doesn't really alleviate D178 objectives or even D178C objectives. I mean, basically, models are requirements. It does address the perceived potential for unintended functions. So, you know, this idea that the model is a black box and you can throw anything into it and it's all going to work okay, you can't do that. You know, you have to identify the model's requirements and apply the D178 objectives. And it doesn't allow models to be verified against themselves. You need some higher-level functional textual requirements to verify against. But what it does do is it promotes and supports the benefits, which there are potential big benefits of using model-based development. Okay, so the object-oriented supplement. So this provides additional guidance for all aspects of using OO and related technologies on D178C. Much of the supplement actually is devoted to establishing some core terminology, background, and interpretation of OO to standardize the terminology and meanings. There are really few, there's only two additional objectives that are identified. Those are to verify local type consistency and to verify the use of dynamic memory management is robust. I'll talk a little bit more about those in more detail later. Okay, so why would you choose to use object-oriented technology? So there's project technical criteria. These are the main ones, really. I mean, would your design benefit from the increased expressive power in the design and code of the things that OO offers, you know, increased encapsulation, class hierarchies, polymorphism? There's nothing really new there. If these were the original drivers behind the development of OO years ago. OO has proved useful to Prosagis in developing our model-based development tools. We found it's very suitable there. There's also environmental criteria. It's does guidance exist? Well, yes, with the 0178C it does. Are human resources engineers available for OO? Are tools available? So by tools, it's not just compilers, it's also code coverage tools, static analysis tools. So in industry currently, these are all currently available, especially for languages like C++. So in summary, OOT is really a viable technique these days, as long as the software design would benefit from its expressiveness. Okay, so some more focus on those two additional OOT objectives for D178C. So the first one, verify local type consistency. So really, put simply, this is just that if you're using polymorphism in your design, you need to verify that the class hierarchy is consistent so that types can be exchanged consistently. This goes back to the, I think, called the Liskov substitution principle, or LSP, which is a well-documented principle out there. Basically, if you're using calls to methods on objects whose class is only known at runtime, that's another word for that is dynamic dispatch. You need to make sure that those methods can be called on the different types that might happen at runtime. And again, basically, it just reflects the decision to use OOT. If you're going to use polymorphism, it's going to help your design. Your verification will benefit from it. And basically, the way you implement this is by inheriting tests the same way that you inherit in your class hierarchy. So it actually helps your verification by making it more systematic, and it models the patterns in your design. The other additional OOT objective is to verify the use of dynamic memory management is robust. The best approach towards this really is to use allocator initialize only paradigm, which is the way we apply it, and that's the way it works best for typical embedded systems anyway, so that you don't have to have like a dynamic memory manager. So in summary, really, there's nothing too onerous or difficult there in terms of new objectives when using OO for D178 projects. Okay, so some specific examples there. So Presagius, we've learned by experience, we use C++ on certification projects for our VAPS-XT178 product. We found that C++ is a good practical trade-off as a language. It's got a wide usage these days. It's got great tool support, great embedded performance. There's no real surprise there, because that's the way C++ was developed. You know, it was a very practical language that was developed to leverage up from the C language. So model-based development and qualifiable tools in OO can really provide important benefits. And to get to my last slide, so to summarize, there's those synergies there in D178C between model-based OOT and tools. It's reducing the level of low-level verifications that need to be done line by line on code. You're able to automate more savings. You know, this is recognized and supported by both the certification authorities and industry. D178C was discussed quite a lot at last week's FAA software conference, and it was rolled out there with presentations on the different sections. These techniques, they enable you to focus more on functionality and component integration than on low-level details. You can work at a higher level. You can execute your model to validate requirements. You can have reliable, qualifiable tool-based code generation. So to put it all together, VAPS-XT178, it embodies all these techniques. It's a HMI development tool that we provide. It uses OO technology. It's model-based development, and it has a qualifiable D178 code generator. So that's the end of my presentation, and back to John.
Thank you very much, Mark, and thank you to all our speakers. And now I'm going to get right started with our Q&A. And the first question we have flows right into the D178C, which would be, is there a standard modeling language, UML, SYSML, that is acceptable for D178C? Anybody like to take that?
I can take that. This is Bernard. So, in fact, the point of view of D178C is not to promote any specific method or standard language. It is to define the rules that have to be applied, but then it is the freedom of the users to choose their own methods or language or any way they want. So this is not going to be the case.
Anybody else want to jump in there, or are we good with that answer?
I was pretty good with it. Yeah, I'd fully agree with what Bernard said there.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Next question. I'm going to keep it on the Bernard track here. I have a question for Bernard. It seems as if the SCADA approach is very much based on or related to MATLAB and Simulink. Is this correct? Are there any similarities? If one was familiar with MATLAB Simulink, would the learning curve be smaller?
There are definitely similarities because this is schema block notation. That is a notation that is very familiar to control engineers, and you find it in Simulink and you find it in SCADA. So this is true. The difference, though, is that we insist more on the safety critical aspects. So this means that there is more rigor, in particular, in the typing view of the notation, doing more controls. And the other point, which is different, is that we have a qualified code generator and they don't have a qualified code generator. But still, the notation is similar, and this is all familiar to control engineers.
Thank you, Bernard. Next question. Will this Ethernet standard be reviewed by the FDA, or has it been presented to the FDA/AVIMED for review? I think that one's for Mirko.
Thank you for this question. Not at this point. My company has medical applications which are highly critical, but we haven't done it yet with this technology. Anyway, I assume because the whole set of chips and technologies formally verified, and also chips are DO254 designed for level A applications. I am quite positive that this can be used also in medical applications. But this requires discussion with FDA, definitely.
Thank you.
Okay.
And next question for on DO178C. What does tool qualification mean between DO178B and or C? Bernard, go ahead.
Yeah, so in fact, as Mark said, there is quite little description of how this is to be done in the D178B document, although it exists. But then there is nothing, it just says do like you do when you certify the software, the airborne software. So the point of view that we had is that there was a need to have a specific document for the qualification of tools, and this is what we've done. We've done similar work on the approach to use to do the qualification of the tool, but we have made it specific for a tool. And a tool is not like airborne software. That is absolutely obvious. So this is why we now have a specific document. And it only speaks about tools. It does not speak about the airborne software itself.
Thank you, Bernard. Another question here on this certification issue. Are these new initiatives going to lead to a reduction in verification versus what was going on with DO178B?
This is not my impression.
Mark?
Mark?
Yeah, I could take that one. It was, I mentioned that in my presentation that really DO178C, it's not raising the bar or lowering the bar. It's really it's standardizing what's been current best practice, particularly for tool qualification there. We're seeing more and more tool qualification, and the increased guidance there is really one of the significant areas of DO178C, I think. So while it's not really changing the expected level, it's making it easier and making there's less room for interpretation. There's more in the guidance. It's easier to reuse tool qualifications. So I hope that answers the question.
Thank you, Mark. And this will be our last question. as we're running out of time. Going back to the first presenter, when will the UCS standard for common ground control stations and other activities are planned for USS, when will the standard be published, and what other activities are planned for the US UCS standardization? Joe?
Yes, John. So we'll publish version, actually it's called Architecture Version 2.1 in December, and that will form the base platform definitions of the service-oriented architecture. There will be ongoing work to augment the safety and security considerations, as well as other parts of the architecture in the next version in the coming year. So they're planning new updates to it, but the first version will actually be the one that can enable a number of those goals that I presented earlier in the presentation today.
Thank you, Joe. And well, that brings us right up to the end of our session today. I'd like to thank all of our presenters, our sponsors, Esterol Technologies, TT Tech, Prestagis, and Wind River. As I mentioned at the beginning, we may not have had time to address all of your questions, but as appropriate, someone may get back to you offline. This ECAS will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 48 hours. Note that an audio-only podcast version will also be available. You also may search for Embedded ECAST on iTunes and find all of OS Systems Media's ECAST available for download as MP3s. Thank you all for attending, and I look forward to seeing you on future webcasts.